The Rashba's dates are 1235 to 1310. He was born in a well-to-do Barcelona family, and he lived his entire life in Barcelona, with the exception of going to visit the Ramban, to learn with the Ramban, and to learn with Rabbeinu Yonah. Here, Rabbeinu Yonah of Gurondi. And otherwise, he spent about 50 years as the rabbinical leader in Barcelona. So we know a great deal about the Rashba through his tshuvas. His tshuvas are printed in 7 volumes. And we catch glimpses of his life in the tshuvas. As I mentioned many times, I enjoy reading tshuvas because it's a glimpse of history. It's not just a halacha. They give a question, but the question is representative of what's going on in the community. So you get sociology and history, anthropology, all in the tshuvas, besides halacha. There, in the 7 volumes, there are over 3,000 tshuvas. So that's a lot of information. But as I go through the story, some of his writings are going to get clouded, and there's still work that has to get done. So work that gets done in a 13th century scholar is stuff that you write a thesis on it. Because otherwise, I don't know too much of in-depth research that goes on in 13th century. So, as I mentioned, his rebbes were the Ramban and Rabbeinu Yonah. Now, the Ramban we covered in this class. Rabbeinu Yonah you might not be as familiar with, but he's a remarkable person as well. I quote him because I hold it by him. When the issue of a makom kavua in a shul. Most people understand that your makom kavua is your seat in the shul. They don't begin to realize that the makom kavua space includes 4 amot from the spot. In other words, about 7 feet. So in other words, if I'm sitting here, and if I sit over here, right next to, that's the same makom kavua. The makom kavua is never defined as a singular individual seat. It spreads out. Rabbeinu Yonah is of the opinion that a makom kavua means that shul. In other words, any place in the shul is your makom kavua. Just think of all the fighting that we would avoid if everyone understood Rabbeinu Yonah's position as a makom kavua. Anyway, he learned from Rabbeinu Yonah and the Ramban. And among his students were Rabbeinu Bachya and the Ritva. But before you get into the rabbinical part of the story, which is the bulk of the story, he comes from a very well-to-do family in Barcelona. And he took three to 5 years as being in finance. Jews in a Christian world could lend money to Christians with interest. And while the Christians could not lend money to other Christians with interest. So anyway, it was easier for a Jew to make it into finance. The king of Aragon was a debtor to the Rashba. After a few years of this, he left finance and became a rabbi. He was a rabbi before he went into finance, too. But he was close to 50 years that he was the rabbi in Barcelona. But his name was out there. He received questions in this tshuvas. He received questions from Germany, France, Bohemia, Sicily, Crete, Morocco, Algiers, Israel, and Portugal and Spain. That means he had a name, had a big name. And except for the end of his life, there wasn't too much turmoil that's recorded in the Rashba's living.
So he's immediately after the Rambam. The Rambam already passed away. Rambam.
No, Rambam died before he was born.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
But he's involved.
Turn to Rambam.
He's involved with the Rambam controversy that's still existing worldwide. All right. Anyway, he had a strong character, incorruptible judgment, and yet he was sensitive to people as well. And he was humble. That's given. He was so renowned that there were times that the king would submit a case to the Rashba for judgment. King Pedro III of Aragon submitted to him a number of complicated cases, but one complicated case between Jews and different communities. And this was against his will. He didn't want to get involved with a case that had to do with non-Jews. But there was one case that King Pedro forced upon the Rashba to decide. It was a case of a Jewish informer of an aristocratic family to trial by order of the king. The Rashba felt that the man was guilty and sentenced him to death. Now, you need to be a strong-willed individual to sentence one of your own Jews to death. But this was a very public case, and one that was submitted to him by the king. 3 years later, the sentence had not been carried out. I guess they had a system like similar to ours, where you could sit on death row for a while. And the relatives of the condemned man appealed the verdict. So the Rashba took it upon himself to refer the case to Rav Meir of Rottenburg in Germany. This was pretty renowned. I mean, it takes a lot of guts to take a case in Spain and refer it to the rabbinic leader in Germany. And guess what? The Maharam Rottenburg sustained the verdict. So you don't have to be Paul Harvey to figure out what happens, that the man is executed. Now, many of his tshuvas, they dealt with Tanakh and how to interpret Tanakh. That's not the makeup frequently of tshuvas. Moshe Feinstein has tshuvas of that nature, but not the majority of tshuvas. The majority of tshuvas are not about that. But in his day, the Rashba's day, the controversy of learning philosophy still existed, especially in Provence, that's southern France, and Spain. So you're dealing with fundamentals of Judaism, and the source of history comes into play as well as a question. How do we know that? How do we know this? The Rambam's grandson, David, named after the Rambam's brother, was denounced to the Sultan of Egypt and was in prison in Egypt. The Rashba collected 25,000 dinars from Spanish communities to secure his release. Now, what I want to impress upon you in the things I've said so far, the international dealings of the Rashba, having a relationship with the Maram in Rotenburg and having a relationship with Egypt, that he becomes involved in giving the Sultan of Egypt 25,000 dinars. So I find this remarkable for 13th century, you know, history, that there is a relationship, because relationships that are international, I mean, just think about it, for the Rashba to find out what happened to the Rambam's grandson in Egypt had to take weeks, and then to be in correspondence with the Sultan of Egypt had to take weeks, if not longer. You know, boats and everything are going, that's true, there's international commerce, but it's, I think it's just so remarkable, and it points to the dignified fashion of correspondence during these days. There were tshuvas also dealing with the structure of the Jewish community and the institutions in the Jewish community, and Batei Dinim, very often he's receiving a question from a Beit Din elsewhere. So those kind of questions take time. It's not like, you know, when Judah Turo died in New Orleans, and this is 1854, and they wanted to put up a statue in the New Orleans community. And there was a curmudgeon fellow from Europe who was claiming that putting up a statue is a violation of the Ten Commandments. Lo ta'aseh lecha pesel. So the community there sent out the question of whether it's permitted to four different rabbis in Europe. Now normally you're not allowed to shop around when you ask a question, but they felt it was necessary to do so because by the time the letter would get to Rav Hirsch in Frankfurt from New Orleans, Rav Hirsch could die. I mean, he could not be there. So in order to cover their tail, something that needed to be answered right away, they submitted their question to Rav Hirsch, the chief rabbi of Frankfurt, chief rabbi of England, chief rabbi of Prague, and there are four. Each one of them received it and sent back an answer. But the answers we received about 1858. It took about 4 years. And then, with the Civil War, the whole thing was moot. They weren't about to extend that kind of money to build a statue of somebody who died with world looming. All right. That's just to give an idea as to how long it takes sometimes to get correspondence. And that's the 19th century. Here we're talking about the 13th century. The controversy about the Rambam and the writings of the Rambam was still in existence. Even though the Ramban was involved, we talked last time. But this time here, now the Rashba is involved. And similar to his Rebbe, he's trying to take a conciliatory note and say that he defends the Rambam, although he opposes an allegorical method of interpreting the Torah. In other words, if Yaakov fought with an angel, he doesn't believe that it's a dream, like the Ralbag and the Rambam. He said that these were dreams, they didn't really occur. And the fact that he's lame, he's got a limp at the end, well, that happens to us too. You have a dream and you become, you're afflicted in some fashion in the morning. So he was against that type of approach to interpretation, but he did not oppose the Rambam's writings. And he basically permitted people to learn the writings of the Rambam. He dealt with false messianism. Now, having a false Mashiach, we have a bunch of them in our history, more than just the ones that you can think of in a second. I mean, Jesus and Shabtai Tzvi and Frank, but there are others, and there were existing in his time as well. Avraham Abulafia was a guy who was making, it's not crystal clear that he was claiming to be the Mashiach, but there was some. And some were not as pronounced as others. But he had to defend Judaism against false messianism. The study of science and philosophy, it was suggested that it be prohibited. He felt that it should be prohibited till the age of 30. And at the age of 30, you're mature and you're fortified with learning. And then you could take on the study of science and philosophy. In 1305, he died in 1310, and he dies at the age of 75. So when he's 70 years old, again, he's involved with the Rambam controversy, and he permitted the study of physics and metaphysics from the age of 25. No restriction at all on the study of astronomy and medicine. And he permitted the reading of all of the Rambam's works. These kind of things caused him sorrows at the end of his life. For the last 10 years of his life, he was drawn into these controversies that at that point, he is the premier rabbinic authority in Spain, if not the world, which is the reason that I've included him in this series. Here, just one tshuva. That comes from
at that point, did they distinguish Sephardi from Ashkenazi?
Oh, for sure. What's that?
But they still, there was interchange because he wrote to
There's correspondence. There's definitely correspondence. But the 13th century did not find a lot of migration of people. You had the rush in the beginning of the 14th century fled Germany and ended up in Toledo. But his family became Sephardim. They didn't map out this a shul. Let's have a minyan. Let's have an Ashkenazic minyan. They never hear of that. Never hear of that. If it's a Sephardi city, then you have to daven Sephardi. And so therefore, all the Rosh's children, Rabbi Yechiel, the Tor Shulchan Aruch, all of them became Sephardim. Okay, so anyway, he's asked a question from Laredo. That's not to be confused with the rabbi down the street. It was Rabbi Laredo. He's asked the question of how do you respond to Christians who are attacking Judaism that we should believe in Jesus and we should convert to Christianity. So usually his tshuvas are quite short, but this one is quite lengthy because he describes a disputation that he was forced to be in. So that's what I mean by you get from the tshuva a historical event. Just like the Ramban, who was forced into a disputation in Barcelona in the year 1263, the Rashba was also forced into disputations. And he gives us, when the Christian says that the Mashiach has already come and wants to prove it from the Pasuk, Lo Yosor Shevet Mihuda, Umachokek Mibein Raglav, Ad Ki Yavo Shiloh, until Shiloh, till the Mashiach comes. So the scepter has to stay within the tribe of Yehuda. So the scepter of rule for the Jews is not in this tribe of Yehuda any longer, because we don't have rule. So therefore, that indicates that the Mashiach has come already. And he goes through a different interpretation of the Pasuk to prove that it wasn't so. Also, there's not a belief in a third temple. You had two temples, and that's all you get. And he says that that's understood from a section of Navi that refers to the second temple as Habayit HaAcharon. So it means the last one. It means there's no third. And the Rashba says that Acharon does not mean the last one. It means the latter one. And he brings a pasuk. If in Shmot, when Hashem gives Moshe Rabbeinu signs to display to the Jewish people that he is a shliach of Hashem, he's a messenger of God, he says, here's one. And here's two. So if you don't believe the first one, they'll believe the last one. And then he says, here's the third one. So it wasn't the last one. It's the Acharon wasn't the last. It was the latter one. So he brings a pasuk to prove that the word Acharon does not necessarily mean the last one. And it because of a pasuk that it refers to the latter one. I have one and two, the second one, okay? So he gives details of the disputation that he himself had. So that was an indication of what was going on in his time. And again, we don't have any history or any comment of a disputation that the Rashba had. It's not anywhere else in anybody's writings. It's not like the Rambam, who had a discussion of the disputation in Barcelona with Pablo Cristiani. I mean, he gave a very detailed diary of daily events in that disputation. And the Dominicans wrote up their version of it as well. And we have them. I mean, that we have this, the disputations of the Ramban. So, but the only indication of a disputation in the life of the Rashba is from the Tshuvas. That's why I say that it's really important that the Tshuvas, we understand the value of responsa. And this is what occurs in the responsa of the Rashba. And thankful that we have over 3,000 responsa. There are some mix-ups of authorship of tshuvas. Some of the latter tshuvas of the Ramban were actually penned by the Rashba. And so scholarship is still needed, it's still lacking in the premier authorship. Okay, he started the yeshiva in Barcelona, and he had students from all over the world. And he funded the yeshiva from his own pocket. As I mentioned, he came from a well-to-do family. He was earning a salary, and back then the Jewish community was autonomous. In other words, Jews had an issue with other Jews. They would never bring it to a non-Jewish court. You had to bring it to the Jewish court. So the Jewish views and the Jewish autonomy was quite well established. And part of your income tax, so to speak, even though it wasn't really income tax, but some of the taxation that a Jew paid went to support the systems of in the Jewish community. So in other words, the shochet, the moel, the rabbi, the chazan, they all received salary from the Jewish community. And that's the way it went. So the Rashba financed his own yeshiva, and they were able to obtain, in this yeshiva, manuscripts from Babylonia and from Kirwan. It's in North Africa. Now that's really cool. Now I have no idea whether Barcelona has a repository today of what existed in the yeshiva of the Rashba. I imagine there is none. But he did write commentary on 17 Masechtot, 17 different Gemaras. The one that's written, his gloss notes from Ketubot, have now, it's understood, that those were actually the notes of the Ramban, and not the notes of the Rashba. So, we have a problem in scholarship work, in the work of academics. And he also wrote a book on the Agadic literature, Chidushei Agadot Hashas, it's called. The first time that comes to print is in 1960 in Tel Aviv. Now, that means that it took a long time to collect them. Where you had a Chiddush on the Agadic literature by the Rashba, and then they collected more, and they got more, and they collected and collected, and then they finally put it out in 1960. The other book that he wrote, he wrote a small book, Torah Tabayit, which dealt with shechita and forbidden slaughtering and forbidden foods, yayin nesech, that's Gentile wine, and nida. Now, it's interesting why this is called Torah Tabayit. Because all these are things that an individual in his own home dealt with. And that was shechita. When I was about 10 years old, we lived in Washington, D.C., and my father took my sister and me to Baltimore, and which was less than an hour, and went to downtown Baltimore, went to the live chicken market, and we bought two live chickens. And then he went then to the Shochet in Baltimore and had the Shochet slaughter him. Then we went back home, went into the basement, and my father gutted the chicken, defeathered the chicken, then koshered the chicken, and made chicken soup. I asked my father, why did we do this?
To encourage you to become a vegetarian.
That's a good answer. But the answer he provided...
I know, I understand.
The answer he provided was a very poignant answer. He said to us, I don't know how long this is going to be visible to you, but this is the way I did it when I was a little kid. And it soon proved to be prophetic, because we don't see shechita here. Shechita is done in the Midwest. We don't see the koshering of meat here. Even when I came, we koshered meat here. But not anymore. It's koshered back at the place of slaughter.
Back at the ranch.
You know, I'll tell you a story. I get a call from Little Rock, Arkansas. There was a trucker who had a truck full of kosher meat out of the Chicago area, somewhere in the Midwest, maybe Omaha. And he had to get it to South Florida within 3 days because the need to kosher. But he had ran into truck problems, and he was at a mechanic in Little Rock, and he saw he wasn't going to make it. So he brought his truck filled with meat to the synagogue. And this guy wasn't Jewish, not at all. But he knew that he had to get it washed. Because if you can wash all the meat, then you get an extension of another 3 days. And then he'll make it to South Florida. So I get a call from the rabbi of Little Rock. How do I kosher this? How do I wash this meat? I told him that I'm very familiar with the truck. And the truck has doors in the back, doors in the side, and also has doors on top. I asked him, do you have a relationship with the fire department? And he said, yes, we do. I said, ask them to come over and to hook up the hose, open it up, get the truck driver to loosen the meat, because the meat is really packed tightly, loosen, and have the water flushed from the top toward the back, so it get out. So he did it, and he calls me the next day and said, everything worked out the way you said. I got the fire department here, opened the door, the truck driver worked on the meat, we moved it. If the only problem I had was when guys came from Mincha, they wanted to know what massacre occurred because there was 2 feet of blood in the entire parking lot. So anyway, We don't do that anymore. Even in the 36 years that I'm here, where that was a standard. And Heshi Nayad, Olav Shalom, used to get the truckload, and he used to kosher it in his store. All the meat was koshered here. So my father was right. You're not going to see shechita. You're not going to see the gutting and the koshering and the defeathering of the animal, of the bird. And that's it. So you have changes going on. Even in our time, the changes. So he wrote Torah Tabayit because in every home, they dealt with this. So they had to know some laws of shechita. Forbidden foods. Wine that was in contact, physical contact, by non-Jews. Because a mevushel wine is something that's factory. But very often they made wine in their homes. I remember visiting a family when I was at YU, and visiting a family in Queens, and the old man, there was a big jug of wine that was fermenting in the corner of the kitchen. These were laws of the house. He wrote a book called Sha'ar HaMayim, which is on the construction of a mikveh. He wrote on Avodat HaKodesh, which is just about Shabbos and holidays. He supported translation work of the Rambam's Perush Mishnayot, commentary on the Mishnah, to be done from Arabic to Hebrew. So again, we're seeing how slowly it took for all the Rambam's writings to be translated into Hebrew. Even though Mor Nevuchim was being translated into Hebrew while the Rambam was still alive by Shmuel Ibn Tibbon in southern France. The only thing we know about his personal life, he had three sons. Yitzchak, Yehuda, and Asterik Shlomo. A-S-T-R-U-C. Asterik Shlomo. Because his name, I don't know. I have no idea why. Because Sfardim would name after the living, so. Okay. But that's all we know of his personal life. The name of his three sons.
And what was his actual name, the Rashba?
Shlomo Ibn Aderet. Or Shlomo Ben Avraham Aderet. It took me a long time to find where it is in the encyclopedia. I first looked up Rashba. I shouldn't get this lucky. There's Rashi, but there's no Rashba. So then I thought, okay, maybe Shlomo. Look up Shlomo. No. Solomon, this one, Solomon ben Avram, Solomon ben... No Shlomo ben Avram out there. So I gave up. And I looked up in the index. In the index of the encyclopedia. And it said, see Aderet. Shlomo ben Avraham, Aderet. They didn't have last names back then. The other parts of the story, Shlomo ibn Aderet. Aderet was... Rav Cook's father-in-law was Aderet. So, I don't know. So there are names that come into popularity and drop out. I guess Aderet was a name that was around, but it got dropped out. Okay. A sample of some of the tshuvas. One tshuva in the first volume is the converted slave. Reuven had a slave. So Shimon took Reuven's slave to the Beit Din and had him converted. So Reuven wants Shimon to pay him for the value of the slave. So the Rashba says, well, if he took him against his will, he's not a convert. The whole thing is a sham. Because you have to have the willingness of the convert. And if he had the willingness of the convert, and Shimon took him to the Beit Din, well, you can't sue somebody for advice. I mean, what are you suing Shimon for? He couldn't literally take the slave and drag him to the... And you're telling me it was willful. That means he told the slave, come with me and I'll get you converted. So he goes. So giving advice is not a suable offense. Which basically is true. I mean, I had a case where I was called to be a dayan in a Beit Din, and it was two former partners. And one partner, ex-partner, was spreading tales about his former partner. So he's saying Lashon Hara against his former partner. So I explained to the two parties, no one can take anybody else to court or a Beit Din for Lashon Hara. You have to prove that you lost financially. That the other guy is Lashon Hara, you end up losing customers. But you got to prove that you lost customers by virtue of the Lashon Hara. That's the way it exists in American law too. Defamation of character in American law is only suable if I can show that I have suffered financially by your defaming my character. So the American law and Jewish law are the same. You can't sue somebody for a defamation of character or for libel.
But aren't there different laws for a Jewish slave and a regular slave?
Yes, but this is a non-Jewish slave. But he was taken to...
But once he converts, then it gets different... It's a different system.
We don't have that. We don't have a Jew serving as a slave for another Jew. Okay, so...
But that's the point.
What?
But that's how he could lose the slave
He could say that I lost him as a slave.
That's right.
By virtue of your converting him.
Exactly.
Well, that's not what that comes down. So the Rashba says it's not a suitable offense because Shimon didn't do it. The slave got converted on his own. And so Shimon's involvement is immaterial. Okay, so, I mean, I remember Thomas Jefferson when he was president of the United States, and there was a reporter, I think from Germany. So he was waiting to see the president, and it was a waiting room, and they had magazines and papers for you to read while you're waiting to see the president. So he read an article that Thomas Jefferson had a sexual relationship, with Sally Hemings, his slave, and it produced children. So when Jefferson met with the guy, the man says, well, is it true? Because I just read in the newspaper in the waiting room, is it true? So Jefferson said, that's out there so that you realize the freedom of the press here. I want you to know where you read it, in the President of the United States waiting room, because we're not afraid to put that out. He never really answered the question. But he made a point that... But the point is, even if we're false, it's not a suable offense. It's for even the President of the United States. Okay, I'm sure they have different laws today. Sedition was an extension of those laws, that if you're causing a traitor or thoughts of being a traitor or a rebel in the United States, that's the acts of sedition. Leave it alone. Sprouted wheat kernels. They would harvest wheat and they would cut it, and initially, before they got it to the silo, they do a whole field, and the field gets piled up with piles of wheat, and then it rains. So some of the kernels begin to sprout. So the questioner is asking, isn't that chametz? Even before you grind it into wheat, it's got to be, it's now be in contact with water. And so the Rashba says, I don't believe you're right. I don't believe that it becomes chametz by sitting out in the rain. And so, again, he's a wise man, for sure, but it's one of controversy, but it also indicates how careful you have to be in order to obey Pesach laws. Okay, dissertation of a Christian scholar. Okay. A wife who wants to take a fertility drug, and she vows to take the fertility drug, and the husband wants to annul the vow because he feels that if she got pregnant, it would nullify her beauty, which is biblical. One of the Lemechs in the Breishit story had two wives, Ada and Sila. So one was the child-producing wife, and the other one was the good-looking wife. It then records that each one had a baby. So their methods of birth control, I guess, were not that great. But there was such a thing of having a wife for beauty. And so the Rashba comments, he can't nullify her vow. And he might have married her for her beauty, but she married him in order to get children. So so you can't deny her that right. Okay. The weak-willed gambler. A person took a vow not to gamble for a certain amount of time. Now he wants his oath annulled because he feels that he's succumbing to temptation and he wants to gamble. So the Rashba writes, we don't agree. He took the vow, he should keep the vow. I mean, people can, listen, in my career, I had a guy come to me. He had taken a vow not to buy a Jaguar. Now he's coming to me to break the vow, that I should institute a Beit Din and break the vow.
For his wife, right? To buy for his wife?
No, it was for him. Oh, for sure. Oh, yeah. Oh, it involved, there was an extension to this conversation that involved your brother-in-law. Because this guy, once he got his Jaguar, he wanted your brother-in-law to shecht a chicken and to pour the blood in front of the Jaguar so the Jaguar would run over the blood. So I asked your brother-in-law, isn't this Avodah Zarah? He says, it was a job. I got paid to do the shechita. That's all I got involved with. So anyway, I know the Zal. I got a beit din together in the library, and a guy came to the library. I said, "Speak up, tell us what you want." And I made him go through the whole thing, just to create the absurdity of the situation, and we annulled his vow. And then I laced into him royally about pitom peh and about what you talk about. Taking a ridiculous vow like that.
So who were the best? There was a best, and obviously approved the vow to Lechatchila. Why would they approve such a vow?
They nullified the vow.
They didn't approve.
That's all.
No, the original, he had to make the vow.
No, make the vow. He doesn't need a baiting.
Oh, you don't know?
No.
This guy made a vow not to
why
bet.
Do you need to, if it wasn't made before a bezin, why do you need a bezin to annul?
You need to bezin to nullify.
Yeah, you do.
Yes, that's clear. Okay, the last tshuva I'll do. Reuven and Shimon are notorious in all these tshuvas, by the way. They get into the weirdest stuff. Reuven is a tailor, and his best customer is a goy, is a non-Jew, who pays up front, unlike Jewish customers, who pays up front, supplies the material, and is a very, very loyal customer. And Reuven charges him 2 dinars per garment. Shimon moves into town, opens on the same block as Reuven, and offers this goy, "I'll make each garment for 1 dinar. So Reuven wants to take Shimon to a beit din for masi gvul, for stealing from him, basically. So the Rashba says, that the Beit Din, you're going to have a hard time proving that Shimon stole from Reuven, because he's got to prove that the goy was going to Reuven's place, and it's just because of past history. Now there's a new place. The goy could be trying out the new place, so that's legitimate. So you'll have a hard time proving the Masi Gvul context of the case. But if it could be proved that he took away Reuven's livelihood, then the Beit Din is appropriately convened, and they could protest Shimon's actions. So he wants to just clarify the definition of Masi Gvul. You know, I was once in Baltimore, and I was a guest of the Star K. So two of the rabbis of the Star K took me out for breakfast, and they took me to a bagel locks place.
Goldberg's.
Who?
Goldberg's.
That's right, Goldberg's. How did you know?
That's the place.
So, and they're under the Star K.
Right.
So I asked Rabbi Rosen, I asked, what happens if another guy opens up next door to serve bagels and lox? Would you give him a hechsher? And without batting an eyelash, Rabbi Rosen answered, "Sure we would. We'll give him a hechsher and let them fight it out in court. Let them go to a beit din and fight it out. But we don't mix the kashrus with the legality of the situation." So that's the way he answered me. We were at that time, I don't know if you remember, with the ORB's policies that you couldn't open within a mile if there was a shawarma place, that you couldn't open another shawarma place within a mile. But that's got so contentious here. I mean, little Hollywood. We have 17.
One on every block.
We have 17 glot places in Little Hollywood, and we've had such a rocky road with being next to each other. I mean, at one point we had two pizza places in that the kosher shopping center with Kosher Central, and so one of them finally got burned out. Not by the other one. There was another issue. It was Israeli mafia action. So they burnt them out, but not because of selling pizza and, you know, virtually around the corner, a small domain. They were selling pizza also. It's very, very hard to prove Masi Gvul, because you actually have to prove that this customer was on his way to Reuven and Shimon intercepted him and brought him into his place. That's the extent of Masi Gvul. But anyway, the Rashba clarifies the situation again. This concludes...
Yes, you go.
Can I ask one question?
Go ahead.
According to what you said, he was liberal, the Rashba was liberal in allowing everyone who was old enough to study the Rambam. And yet he probably was the greatest adversary in terms of the halachas that the Rambam ruled.
No, not halachas.
Well, in his writings, I see the Rashba is always opposed, is always anti. He feels that the Rambam was too lenient in his interpretations.
Machloket between the Rishonim,
right,
is common, but I don't think there's a purpose in the Rashba writing to be the adversary of the Rambam. I mean, he might have issues with the Rambam here and there, but the only real problems with caused the Maimonidean controversy was Morei Nevuchim, what's called philosophy, was the understanding the reasons for mitzvahs and associating them with Aristotelian thought. So that's where the Rambam. People didn't have a question about the Rambam's credentials in writing halachas. You could disagree with them.
That's what I meant.
He overwhelmingly approved his writings. And you might find places where he disagreed.
Yeah, I'm saying he was the biggest disagreeer.
I don't think he's the biggest.
What's the story about the grain and the rain? Is that chometz or not?
No. He felt that there was
no way he felt. How would we pass today?
Same way. Yep. Okay.
My wife would